following is an Audio Renaissance presentation.
Hello, I'm Bill Hartley, president of Audio Renaissance, and I'm very pleased to introduce you to our presentation of The Hero with a Thousand Faces, Volume 2, The Cosmogonic Cycle. In our first volume of The Hero with a Thousand Faces, we presented an adaptation of the first section of the book, The Adventure of the Hero, which details Joseph Campbell's vision of the world's mythologies, folktales, rituals, and rites of passages as different branches stemming from the same root, man's psyche, and that insight into their basic meaning, as well as their similarities, can be found by studying the symbology in the same way that dreams are analyzed. In The Cosmogonic Cycle, Joseph Campbell extends that concept, now presenting the basic structure of the hero's adventure as an analogy for the never-ending cycle of birth, life, and death of the world. As with Volume 1, Ralph Blum narrates the passages from the book, and where possible, we've augmented the text with excerpts from live recordings of Joseph Campbell speaking in seminar. This program begins with a restatement of the basic ideas set forth in the hero's journey, and then proceeds to the cosmogonic cycle. And now, may I introduce you to Ralph Blum, reading from Joseph Campbell's The Hero with a Thousand Faces, Volume 2, The Cosmogonic Cycle.
Sigmund Freud wrote, "The truths in religious doctrines are, after all, so distorted and systematically disguised that the mass of humanity cannot recognize them as truth." This is similar to what happens when we tell a child that newborn babies are brought by the stork. We are telling the truth in symbolic clothing, for we know what the large bird signifies. But the child does not know it. He hears only the distorted part of what we say and feels that he has been deceived. It is the purpose of this tape to uncover some of the truths disguised for us under the figures of religion and mythology. There are, of course, differences between the numerous mythologies and religions of mankind, but this is a tape about the similarities, and once these are understood, the differences will be found to be much less great than one might suppose. But first, we must learn the grammar of the symbols, and as a key to this mystery, I know of no better modern tool than psychoanalysis. Without regarding this as the last word on the subject, one can nevertheless permit it to serve as an approach. The second step will be then to bring together a host of myths and folk tales from every corner of the world and to let the symbols speak for themselves. The parallels will be immediately apparent, and these will develop a vast and amazingly constant statement of the basic truths by which we have lived throughout the millenniums of our residence on the planet. It is not difficult for the modern intellectual to concede that the symbolism of mythology has a psychological significance. Particularly after the work of the psychoanalysts, there can be little doubt either that myths are of the nature of dream, or that dreams are symptomatic of the dynamics of the psyche. Whatever may be thought of the sometimes contradictory interpretations of specific cases and problems, Freud, Jung, and their followers have demonstrated irrefutably that the logic, the heroes, and the deeds of myth survive into modern times.
Shakespeare speaks of art as a mirror held up to nature. Mythology is a mirror held up to nature. But it's not just a gross mirror on the wall showing you that thing which you've known about all the while. It's a kind of X-ray mirror that opens up the form principle within you. And it's out of your dreams that you bring your myths. There are aspects of dreams that are completely personal. A person tells you his dream, you don't know anything about the person, what kinds of things have worked in his life, there's nothing you can do with it except ask the person, well, what do you think it means? On the other hand, there are dreams that immediately sound like myths. One finds oneself recognizing them. These are the things that are linked to the great heritage of mythology. How does they get in the person? When one reads Freud, one's reading of an unconscious that is based on conscious experiences which have become unconscious. The experiences of infancy and childhood that have been forgotten, rejected, repressed are the principal concern of the Freudian analysis. These are biographical. The dream imagery that Freud is interpreting and his mode of interpretation has to do with the biography of the individual. Now, in Jung, on the other hand, we find, besides that level of the individual biography, which he calls the personal unconscious, that aspect of your system of images, which is dependent for its existence on the actual experiences of your personal life, besides that, we have a level of the unconscious that is based on the common physical heritage of human beings. We all have the same body. Also, the experience of daylight life and then night experience and dream. These are two worlds. All human beings have these. So there is a general common base, and that was what he was talking about as the collective unconscious. But this common base becomes differently inflected in different culture periods and different culture milieu. So there is a kind of ethnic unconscious also. That is one of the difficulties in reading Jung. And so when he speaks about collective unconscious, he really means two things, and he says so later on. He means, on the one hand, the collectivity of impulse and concern of all human beings because they all have the same human body. And on the other hand, the collectivity of a given culture heritage. He points out, for instance, the difference between the mythological mode of the Jewish tradition and the mythological mode of the traditions of the nations around the Hebrew race at the time of the coming into the flower of the Hebrew tradition. Those are ethnic communities. We have a basic human community. When he speaks about the race, he means the human race, and then we have the ethnic communities as well.
According to this view, it appears that through the wonder tales, which pretend to describe the lives of legendary heroes, symbolic expression is given to the unconscious desires, fears, and tensions that underlie the conscious patterns of human behavior. Mythology, in other words, is psychology misread as biography, history, and cosmology. We have only to read it, study its constant patterns, analyze its variations, and come to an understanding of the deep forces that have shaped man's destiny and must continue to determine both our private and our public lives.
Copernicus announced the heliocentric universe, 1543. That was the first cosmological concept that was not based on the visual experience of man on Earth. Now, that heliocentric universe is something that has been visually experienced by hundreds of thousands of people. And all of your children are going to take it for granted. This extension of earthly experience to what were formerly thought to be totally different cosmic bodies simply brings before us all what Galileo worked out when he applied the principles of ballistics and the movements of propelled bodies on Earth to an interpretation of the orbit of the planets and other heavenly spheres. Now, as you all undoubtedly remember, the Inquisition roundly, thoroughly, and explicitly condemned the heliocentric universe as being contrary to scriptures and consequently untrue. This was done quite clearly and emphatically. Luther also condemned Copernicus as simply a clown trying to refute scripture. Well, what we can say now is that the scriptural interpretation of mythology has been completely refuted by these events. One could only say that when mythological symbols are interpreted in that manner, they simply are being misinterpreted. And the first point I want to make is that one of the great problems of our relationship to the mythological imagery is that they have been consistently interpreted in historical, geographical, and cosmological terms. And we now have refuted all of those interpretations. And so the imagery of our mythological heritage has been disqualified for us. It seems not to be of any real relevance to contemporary life. A point that I want to bring up is that the origin of the mythological symbols is not pseudo-scientific, pseudo-historical. They spring from the psyche. They are not the consequence of observations. They are the consequence of observations misinterpreted through projections from the human psyche. And these symbols, which are of great significance psychologically, have, as a consequence of their interpretation as history and cosmology, been taken away from us. They no longer are working. From my point of view, the imagery of myth is the imagery through which our own nature, our unconscious nature, communicates with our consciousness. And they have in the past, when the symbols have been received simply and naively, without criticism, operated to keep the conscious programs and life in touch with the unconscious motivations. But when these symbols are removed, as they have been for us, there takes place a disconnection. We hear all over the place these days of alienation. And in terms of the concerns of my science and thinking, one can interpret this alienation as the consequence of the loss of those vehicles or instruments of communication by which we would have kept our consciousness in touch with our own root nature. And then we seek the nature in other ways, going back into the country, or becoming, as it were, primitives, or one way or another, leaving the world of our civilization to go back and find roots, as though those roots are outside. The roots are really inside, and they can be found by way of these, of a restoration, a reactivation of the real communication which these symbols originally rendered.
But if we are to grasp the full value of the materials, we must note that myths are not exactly comparable to dream. Their figures originate from the same sources, the unconscious wells of fantasy, and their grammar is the same, but they are not the spontaneous products of sleep. On the contrary, their patterns are consciously controlled, and their function is to serve as a powerful picture language for the communication of traditional wisdom. The shaman and the priest are not unsophisticated in the wisdom of the world, not unskilled in the principles of communication by analogy. The metaphors by which they live have served whole societies as the mainstays of thought and life. And if this be true of the comparatively simple folk mythologies by which the primitive hunting and fishing tribes support themselves, what may we say of such magnificent cosmic metaphors as those reflected in the great Homeric epics, the Divine Comedy of Dante, the Book of Genesis, and the timeless temples of the Orient? Obviously, we are in the presence of immense consciousness rather than darkness. And so, to grasp the full value of the mythological figures that have come down to us, we must understand that they are not only symptoms of the unconscious, but also controlled and intended statements of certain spiritual principles which have remained constant throughout the course of human history. Briefly formulated, the universal doctrine teaches that all things and beings are the effects of the power out of which they arise, power which supports and fills them during the period of their manifestation and back into which they must ultimately dissolve. This is the power known to science as energy, to the Melanesians as mana, to the Sioux Indians as Wakonda, to the Hindus as Shakti, and to the Christians as the power of God. The function of ritual and myth is to make possible and then to facilitate the jump by analogy. Forms and conceptions that the mind can comprehend are presented and arranged in such a way as to suggest truth. And then, the conditions for meditation having been provided, the individual is left alone. They are mere symbols to move and awaken the mind and to call it past themselves.
The first function, one might say, of every mythology has always been a mystical, metaphysical function. That of awakening in the mind and spirit of the individual a sense of awe before the mystery of being itself. This is the mystery dimension. And the first function of mythology is to communicate that so that in the field of mythological forms and of the rites by which those you participate in those forms, you are made aware experientially of the ultimate, absolute mystery of the universe, which cannot be caught in words. It absolutely transcends all conceptualizations, and it breaks past all fields of meaning. The world, the universe, life, being itself, is absolutely without meaning. It is antecedent to meaning. Meanings are the mental interpretations, and these vary. These are what vary. The meanings given. Now, not only the universe itself, but also the imagery of myth is intrinsically without meaning. It is a being statement. And the experience of the, you know, getting turned on, or the ripple or buzz, comes when all of your meaning interpretations smash, break up, and what has been called the mysterium tremendum et fascinans, the fascinating, tremendous mystery of this whole thing, comes zooming through. Now, it is a tremendous mystery. And it's an appalling, monstrous mystery. Just think of the nature of life itself. It lives on life. The prime image of life is this consuming monster, which would not be there if it were not consuming life. That's the sense of the image of the Ouroboros consuming its own tail and eating itself. The fantastic Indian myth of this great deity Shiva. And Shiva was approached by a monster who demanded possession of Shiva's consort, Parvati. And Shiva, in a moment of great wrath, simply let a blast go forth from this eye, and there, materialized, was a monster avid to eat, to consume. Well, monster number one was one-upmanshiped by this second monster, and appalled by what confronted him, he threw himself at Shiva's feet, throwing himself on the god's mercy. Well, now in, you know, metaphysical, let's say, ethics, when that happens, the god, of course, has to protect. So, being asked to protect, the god did indeed protect. So, well, monster number two says, well, what about it? You brought me forth simply as a creature of hunger. What shall I do now? Whom shall I eat? So Shiva had a brilliant thought. He says, eat yourself. So the deity did. He started with his hands and feet, and he went right up the line. And Shiva looked at this with great satisfaction. And finally, all that was left was the face. Now, this face, Shiva said, this is utterly admirable. And I'm going to have this face as the guardian of my temples. And you'll see in many Indian temples this strange mask with tusks but no chin. He's already eaten that much. And it's just what's left on top there as a symbol of what life is. And this is called Kirti Mukha, which means shining face, the wonderful face of glory. This is a symbol of life. This is the ultimate thing about it. It's a monster. It's an avid, grabbing, eating, self-consuming thing. Life is a self-consuming monster. So that one of the functions of myth has always been to reconcile consciousness to this monstrous thing, which is the precondition of its own existence.
The standard path of the mythological adventure of the hero is a magnification of the formula represented in the rites of the passage: separation, initiation, return. The formula in the vast majority of myths is as follows. A hero ventures forth from the common world of day into a region of supernatural wonder. Fabulous forces are there encountered, and a decisive victory is won. The hero comes back from this mysterious adventure with the power to bestow boons on his fellow beings. Prometheus ascended to the heavens stole fire from the gods, and descended. Jason sailed through the clashing rocks into a sea of marvels, circumvented the dragon that guarded the golden fleece, and returned with the fleece and the power to wrest his rightful throne from a usurper. As we shall see, whether presented in the vast images of the Orient, in the narratives of the Greeks, or in the legends of the Bible, the adventure of the hero normally follows the pattern described. The mythological hero, setting forth from his common-day hut or castle, is lured, carried away, or else voluntarily proceeds to the threshold of adventure.
This departure, what I call the call to adventure, on your own, doing your own thing, may come in a way of sudden call, in a way of gradual realizations. In the myths, it is normally represented as someone appearing, saying, come with me. I call it the twinkle, twinkle motif. The horizon seems beautiful, and you go toward that. This is the call to adventure. A hero in the Celtic myths very frequently is following an animal in the forest. The animal kind of keeps avoiding and lures him into parts of the forest he's never been in before, and then the adventure starts. Or someone will say, look, they've run off with Helen of Troy, so let's all get going and get her back again. Something may be stolen, taken away. Now, there are two kinds of starting out to adventure. One is the one that is yours. It has come to you in the way of an inner voice or a readiness for a certain kind of adventure. The other is following a crowd. That's not being your adventure. If it's going to be your adventure, there will appear, as you approach what I call the threshold of adventure, the threshold of real danger, getting out of bounds, there will appear a little guiding voice. I'm calling this magical aid. A little dwarf, a little animal, a little worm will say, where are you going? And you will say, such and such and such and such. And the voice will say, well, this is very dangerous. You can't do that. And you will say, yes, but I know I'm going to do it. And they'll say, well, here's a little thought to hold in your mind. Or here's a little trinket to have hanging from your chest. Or here's something else that's going to guide you and protect you and carry you through this journey. You're given magical aid. You're a little guide. And when you're in trouble, hang on to that, kid, and forget everything else. But then you come to the edge of the world. That place psychologically that no one has ever explored for you, that you have to do on your very own. And this I call the threshold of adventure. Before that, you're in more or less mapped out territory. There are a number of typical crises representing this point. What emerges to confront you is the absolute danger of darkness. This will be represented in the form of an typical creature, a dragon, a whale. And in the Arthurian romance is often a knight in black armor with visor down, so it's just this impersonal monster. And when he is defeated and the visor is taken off, he's the hero's brother. The brother battle, dragon battle, Jonah in the whale's belly, the whale comes and the whale is the abyss, swallows him down, whale's belly. In the whale's belly, the hero goes into the abyss alive. In the crucifixion, he goes in dead. He goes through the cross, goes through the midpoint, leaves the four dimensions behind him, goes through the midpoint, the sun door. This is the image of the what the Germans call the Klappfelsen, the Symplegades, the clashing rocks. The pair of opposites, good and evil, true and false, this and that, you're going through it. You go through just at the moment when the crash comes. So you have the dismemberment, the going into the underworld, what is called the night sea journey. And now, moving toward the nadir, the exact opposite of everything you've been taught, you experience a series of increasingly terrible and terrifying tests. This has become, in many folk mythologies, a very popular theme. The hero who simply is depicted surviving tests. Then, and now we come to the critical crisis, comes the realization. Now, this is rendered in four different ways, each way representing a sort of style of thought, a mood or mode, a style of mythology. A is the Hieros Gamos, the sacred marriage. That's to say, the union of pairs of opposites in male-female term. The hero marries the goddess. The nymph is married to the god. This is the virgin birth motif. The symbology of pairs of opposites united, of temporal and eternal principles identified, is rendered in terms of the sexual polarity. This is the way of most of the fairy tales, many of the classical myths, infinite number of Oriental myths, and so forth. The second kind of crisis is that of father at one-ment, atonement. Now, this can be depicted as atonement, as it is in the biblical tradition, where we are atoned with the Father, or as at-one-ment, when Christ says, I and the Father are one. The word atonement actually is made up of these two, and it has these two different meanings. This is the way in patriarchal mythologies, in which case, very often, the last test and temptation is that of a sexual temptation. The temptation of sex as the final temptation to be transcended, the ascetic tradition. These are the ways of the mythologies that we're most familiar with. The third way is what I call apotheosis, where the hero realizes that he is the divine being himself. This is the way of the Buddha, who becomes the Buddha. He isn't atoned with any father. He isn't united with any goddess. He realizes, tattvamasi, thou art that, I am that. That is full realization. These are the three high modes of realization symbolized in the high religions. There is a fourth motif, which is that of many of the most popular and vivid myths. It is that of the fire or bride theft. Prometheus stealing the fire from the guardians, male or female. This represents a kind of violence. You have come with the purpose of achieving one aspect of the total goal. You grab it, and not having appeased all the forces on the way down, you become assailed then by those unpropitiated powers. And there is then necessary a flight. This is the way of quest. That's the first half of the story. Now comes the way of return. Dante went through the three worlds, but came back and wrote about it. You know the magic flight, it's very favorite of the fairy tales. The hero or little Hansel and Gretel or somebody like this are running away from a pursuing monster, and they throw things over their shoulder. They throw a comb over, it becomes a forest, and the monster comes through until finally we get to the threshold again, back to the light world, and you're out. Now, this threshold of return is no joke. It is very often more difficult than the quest. Here you were following your lure, the allure of the unknown. Now you're going back to something that you had left behind.
At the return threshold, the transcendental powers must remain behind. the hero reemerges from the kingdom of dread. The boon that he brings restores the world. Typically, the hero of the fairy tale achieves a domestic, microcosmic triumph, and the hero of a myth, a world-historical, macrocosmic triumph. Whereas the former prevails over his personal oppressors, the latter brings back from his adventure the means for the regeneration of society as a whole. Tribal or local heroes commit their boons to a single folk. Universal heroes, Muhammad, Jesus, Gautama Buddha, bring a message for the entire world. Heaven, hell, the mythological age, Olympus, and all the other habitations of the gods are interpreted by psychoanalysis as symbols of the unconscious. The key to the modern systems of psychological interpretation, therefore, is this. The metaphysical realm equals the unconscious. The key to open the door the other way is the same equation in reverse. The unconscious equals the metaphysical realm. For, as Jesus states it, "Behold, the kingdom of God is within you." Redemption consists in the return to superconsciousness, and therewith the dissolution of the world. This is the great theme and formula of the cosmogonic cycle, the mythical image of the world's coming to manifestation and subsequent return into the non-manifest condition. The birth, life, and death of the individual may be regarded as a descent into unconsciousness and return. The adventure of the hero represents the moment in his life when he achieved illumination, the moment when, while still alive, he found and opened the road to the light beyond the dark walls of our living death. A magnificent version of the cosmogonic round is presented in the mythology of the Jains. The most recent prophet and savior of this very ancient Indian sect was Mahavira, a contemporary of the Buddha. His parents were already followers of a much earlier Jaina prophet, Prashvanatha. Centuries before Prashvanatha, there lived and died the Jaina savior Neminatha, declared to have been a cousin of the beloved Hindu incarnation Krishna. And before him were exactly 21 others, going all the way back to Rishabhanatha, who existed in an earlier age of the world, when men and women were always born in wedded couples, were 2 miles tall, and lived for a period of countless years. Rishabhanatha instructed the people in the sciences, cooking, sewing, and the arts. He introduced them to politics and established a kingdom. Before his day, such innovations would have been superfluous, for the people of the preceding period, who were 4 miles high and enjoyed a lifespan of 2 periods of countless years, were supplied in all their needs by 10 wish-fulfilling trees, which gave sweet fruits, had leaves that were shaped like pots and pans, leaves that sweetly sang, leaves that gave forth light at night, food perfect to both sight and taste, and bark providing beautiful clothes. One of the trees was like a many-storied palace in which to live. Another shed a gentle radiance like that of many little lamps. The earth was sweet as sugar, the ocean as delicious as wine. And then again, before this happy age, there had been a period happier still, precisely twice as happy, when men and women had been 8 miles tall. When these superlative people died, they passed directly to the world of the gods without ever having heard of religion, for their natural virtue was as perfect as their beauty. The Jains conceive of time as an endless round. Time is pictured as a wheel with 12 spokes or ages, classified in 2 sets of 6. The first set is called the descending series and begins with the age of the superlative giant couples, endures for 10 millions of 10 millions of 100 millions of 100 million periods of countless years, and then yields slowly to the only half as blissful period when men and women are only 4 miles tall. In the third period, happiness is mixed with a little sorrow and virtue with a little vice. At the conclusion of this period, men and women are no longer born together in couples to live together as man and wife. During the fourth period, the gradual deterioration of the world and its inhabitants steadily continues. The lifespan and stature of humanity slowly diminish. 23 world saviors are born, each restating the eternal doctrine of the Jains in terms appropriate to the conditions of the time. 3 years, 8 1/2 months after the death of the last of the saviors and prophets, Mahavira, this period, comes to an end. Our own age, the fifth of the descending series, began in 522 BC and will last for 21,000 years. No Jain savior will be born during this time, and the eternal religion of the Jains will gradually disappear. It is a period of unmitigated and gradually intensifying evil. The tallest human beings are only 7 cubits tall, and the longest lifespan no more than 125 years. People are selfish, unjust, violent, lustful, proud, and avaricious. But in the 6th of the descending stages, the state of humanity and the world will be still more horrible. The longest life will be only 20 years, 1 cubit will be the greatest stature, the days will be hot, the nights cold, disease will be rampant, and chastity non-existent. Tempests will sweep over the earth, and toward the conclusion of this period, these will increase. In the end, all life, human and animal, and all the vegetable seeds will be forced to seek shelter in the Ganges, in miserable caves, and in the sea. The descending series will terminate, and the ascending series begin, when the tempest and desolation will have reached the point of the unendurable. For 7 days, then, it will rain, and 7 different kinds of rain will fall. The soil will be refreshed, and the seeds will begin to grow. Out of their caves, the horrible dwarf creatures of the arid, bitter earth will venture, and very gradually there will be perceptible a slight improvement in their morals, health, beauty, and stature, until, presently, they will be living in a world such as the one we know today. And then a savior will be born, named Padmanatha, to announce again the eternal religion of the Jains. The stature of humanity will approach again the superlative. The beauty of humanity will surpass the splendor of the sun. At last, the earth will sweeten and the waters turn to wine. The wish-fulfilling trees will yield their bounty of delights to a blissful population of perfectly wedded twins. And the happiness of this community again will be doubled. And the wheel, through 10 millions of 10 millions, of 100 millions, of 100 million periods, of countless years, will approach the point of beginning the downward revolution which will again lead to the extinction of the eternal religion.
Now let me tell you this primordial myth, which one finds throughout the tropical zone, and you may recognize some of its details. There was a time when there was no time, when people and plants and animals could not be distinguished from each other. These are called, in the Melanesian area, the Dima, or we might call them the eternal ones of the dream. The ancestors. One of these ancestors was killed, was cut up. The parts were buried. And from the buried parts, there grew the food plants on which people live. Simultaneously with this coming of death into the world, that's the coming of death, the beginning of time, the sexes were separated from each other and the sexual organs appeared and the act of begetting became possible. So that simultaneously with death, there came birth and there came eating. In other words, the world as we knew it, as we know it, came into being with the mythological event of a killing. In order to refresh the world, that event is repeated, is imitated in rites. This kind of rite is a renewal, a reenactment of the primordial event on which all life depends. It is enacted visually, in fact, before the eyes of the community. Everybody participating in it. There is a very fine work by a man named Paul Wirtz, a Swiss anthropologist, describing the rites of the Marind Anim of West New Guinea. These rites are as follows. At the time of the boys' initiations, they are about to become little adults. At the end, there are 3 days of general Saturnalian sexual license in which the boys do not participate. In these initiations, there'll be about half a dozen or 7 or 8 youngsters being initiated. The last night, the dance ground is swept nice and clean.
The great big split log drums are being beaten. You know that type of drum with the log, a hollow log, and the resonation. Those are the mouths of the ancestral spirits, and the sound of the drums is the sound of the ancestral voices. Everybody is dancing. There is, at the side, a great lean-to of heavy logs, one end on the ground, the other end supported by a crossbeam that is itself supported by two uprights. A girl comes in, beautifully arrayed, with a great headdress of pandanus leaves and so forth, looking like one of the ancestral spirits. She lies down in that place under the lean-to of heavy logs, and one by one, the initiated boys has intercourse with her in his first official sexual experience. The last boy, who has been selected for this as being the most beautiful of all, just as she has been selected as the most beautiful of all, when he is with her, the supports are withdrawn, and when they are in full embrace, the logs drop and they are immediately killed. This is the reuniting of death and sex. Then they are dragged out, cut up, roasted, and consumed in a sacramental meal. This is the renewal of the mystery, to let you know that what you eat when you eat is the body of the god. The god has sacrificed himself for you. Now this is to be done with joy, with gratitude, everybody participating as members of this world community which lives on death. This is the monstrous thing that I mentioned earlier, which is made vivid before the eyes of everybody in order that they may know what life is.
Just as the journey of the hero is similar in all myths, the cosmogonic cycle is presented with astonishing consistency in the sacred writings of all the continents, and it gives to the adventure of the hero a new and interesting turn. For now, it appears that the perilous journey was a labor not of attainment, but of reattainment, not of discovery, but rediscovery. The godly powers sought and dangerously won are revealed to have been within the heart of the hero all the time. He is the king's son who has come to know who he is. From this point of view, the hero is symbolical of that divine, creative, and redemptive image which is hidden within us all, only waiting to be known and rendered into life. We read in the writings of St. Simeon the Younger, "I saw him in my house. Among all those everyday things, he appeared unexpectedly and became unutterably united and merged with me, and leapt over to me without anything in between, as fire to iron, as the light to glass. And he made me feel like fire and like light. And I became that which I saw before and beheld from afar. I do not know how to relate this miracle to you. I am man by nature, and God by the grace of God." The two, the hero and his ultimate God, are thus understood as the outside and inside of a single self-mirrored mystery, which is identical with the mystery of the manifest world. The great deed of the supreme hero is to come to the knowledge of this unity in multiplicity, and then to make it known. The effect of the successful adventure of the hero is the unlocking and release again of the flow of life into the body of the world.
Please fast forward to the end and turn the tape over for proper cueing of side two.